Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll be talking to mystery writer Katrina McPherson, who will be the guest speaker at the Chico Library next Tuesday. What do you do when your children keep requesting recipes from their childhood? Well, if you're Chico resident Dave Morgan, you collect favorite recipes into a book tested by five generations. Dave Morgan's mother was a member of Mensa and sometimes channeled her superior intellect into being creative with food. When Dave Morgan was 17, he left the ranch in Oklahoma where he grew up and came west to Stanford. He is now retired from careers in computer software, hotel management, kiwi fruit farming, and fruit packing. Dave Morgan, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be anywhere my age, but I'm here.
Well, the cover of your book is quite colorful. Why don't you describe the cover for it? Well, first, tell us what you decided to call your cookbook.
Well, it's called Morgan Favorites. The family is named Morgan, and these are their favorites. And on my third or fourth try, I figured out that it had been tested by five generations. And we don't know the results of those tests yet, but we're working on it.
Well, there's a photograph of you, and you have a chef's hat, a toque.
Yes, I'm wearing my toque.
And you actually have one of those at home, I guess. That's your very own chef's hat.
Yes, I have a toque. I wear it for the Rotary Omelet Breakfast, which is coming up more or less the 1st of May this year.
So you are a member of the Rotary Club. And when you have a pancake breakfast, you're the designated chef.
Well, it's not pancakes, it's omelets.
Oh, excuse me.
And so, yes, I'm the one who wears the toque. And so all the little kids get in a line, get in my line for me to cook their omelets because they know I'm a real cook because I have the toque on.
Well, back to the photograph. You have on your chef's hat and you have an apron. And in one hand, you have what looks like a nonstick surface griddle? That's a griddle?
It's a frying pan.
Because it couldn't tell. It looks kind of like a frying pan. But
yeah.
And then the other hand, you have this wooden, quite attractive implement that I don't know if most people have heard of, but I think the word is just fun to say.
Well, I always wanted to get a picture of me holding my spurtle, and there it is. And so those of you who can't look it up on the internet, a spurtle has been used for centuries by Scottish people to stir their oatmeal. And it's just a wooden stir stick.
And it can stir other things besides oatmeal.
I don't know. I'm not sure that's ever been tried.
So when you are holding this spurtle in your hand, that's all you use it for, stirring oatmeal?
That's what I use mine for.
Well, the Scots would be pleased. My guest is Dave Morgan, and he has put together a collection of recipes that he calls Morgan Favorites. And he calculated that there have been five generations that have passed down these recipes.
Well, they've all worked on them. Some of them go way back. Several I've invented myself. Others I have, I can't say stolen because that would be admitting something. So I've borrowed them, and I've edited them, and I've improved them, and
Well, for example, when you say stole, that's you're not exactly stealing, because I notice your recipe for pancakes is the same one that I use at home. I don't make pancakes anymore, but my husband used to follow this recipe. He liked pancakes, and he would make pancakes. And where did you get your recipe for pancakes?
Well, this particular recipe is a result of some evaluations, some formal professional evaluations by Consumer Reports. And they tested them all, and this is the one that works.
And it's very basic. I mean, you couldn't get more basic than this recipe for pancakes that's in your book.
That's right. And my 10-year-old granddaughter can make her own pancakes, and she's very pleased with that.
So this is an instance where you took a tried-and-true recipe from Consumer Reports for your pancake recipe. But now you have such a wide variety of recipes. They're not that many. How many recipes are there? I didn't count because you don't have page numbers in your book. Dave, I wish you had page numbers because I'd want to refer back to a recipe and I couldn't find it very easily. But you have such a variety of recipes.
Well, that's everything we eat. There's 40 recipes. And I have to say that the next edition, which is coming sometime, we'll have more. And so I've already gotten some flack from family members. Hey, you don't have the green chili stew in there. Mm-hmm. And that's right. That was an error of omission. That's probably the first mistake I've made this year.
Well, before we continue with the recipes, I was intrigued by some photographs of you. I think you put them together for a college reunion.
Well, yes, I had my big reunion this last summer.
And when I was looking at these photographs, there's one of you in a cowboy hat standing in front of a movie poster. Were you in a movie?
Well, actually, I was. I was an extra in Contact with Jodie Foster. And I remember her. She doesn't remember me.
Well, now, did you have any lines or are you just standing around?
No, I was impersonating an attorney, and I didn't say anything, so I wouldn't have been that good of an impersonation because.
So that was the extent of your movie career.
That's right.
Well, another photograph, you're standing in front of a brick wall that we recognize as the Comedy Store. Did you do a stand-up routine in the Comedy Store?
Well, yes. Not the...
The real Comedy Store.
Well, there are several Comedy Stores. I mean, there's probably one in Los Angeles that you're more familiar with. Mm-hmm. This one was closer to home. And we had, I'm not sure how it came to this, but we had a stand-up comedy night. And so I did some of my stand-up.
Can you give us an example?
Oh, no. No, that's... That's you have to pay for that.
Okay.
And, I'll try to come up with something, but move on. Next question.
In fact, I'm going to remind people that you're here because you collected some recipes, and your book is called Morgan Favorites, Tested by Five Generations. But I couldn't help. I wanted to ask you about your movie career, your stand-up comedy routine. And then, are you still a manager of a softball team?
Oh, yes. I'm the manager of the Good Old Boys. We play senior softball here in Chico at Sycamore Field in Bidwell Park. Starting this week, we have two games at 5 o'clock and 6:30. And I was going to say it's good, clean fun. Let's just say it's good fun. And it's mostly family friendly, and it's extremely entertaining. There are single old ladies that come out. Pardon me. There are single ladies who come out to observe the elder studs out there playing softball and showing off and hitting and throwing and running.
Well, there's a photograph of you swinging a baseball or a softball bat. So in addition to manage, do you still play softball yourself, or are you just manager now?
Did you say still? Come on. Although I'm in my seventh decade, I have guys on my team that are 10 years older than I am. I mean, I have an 83-year-old first baseman. I mean, these guys are well-preserved, and they get out there and show you how it's done. So it's a wonderful spectator.
But I didn't hear the answer to the question if you are still out there on the diamond yourself.
The reason I'm the manager is that I get to decide who pitches. And since I'm the manager, it's me.
So you're the team, your team's the Good Old Boys, you're the pitcher, softball pitcher for the Good Old Boys.
Yes, I am. And we might be playing the underdogs. The Underdogs are managed by Doug Keister, and he's a,
oh my goodness,
he's a famous local guy.
He has authored a lot of books. He's a photographer, and he has a whole I don't even know how many books Doug Keister has.
Well, if you ask him, he'll tell you. And so we are just two of the managers. There are lots of other personalities there.
Well, now I'm wondering. I think you say that you played senior softball for 20 years. I mean, you did say you're in your seventh decade, but you've been playing senior softball for 20 years?
Yeah, you have to be 50 to start.
So as soon as you turn 50, you are out there swinging a softball bat.
That's right.
My guest is Dave Morgan, and he is a Chico resident now. He's had careers in computer software, hotel management. Where did you manage a hotel?
I built and managed a 100-room hotel in Marin County, and I was elected to be the president of the California Lodging Industry Association, an organization of 1,000 hotel owners, and I was able to bring some intellect to that job.
Well, now, speaking of intellect, I mentioned earlier that your mother was a member of Mensa. And she must have been an interesting person because you have a recipe in your book and you mentioned that your mother, this recipe that she got when she was at the embassy in Sofia, Bulgaria?
Well, yes. She grew up in Kansas and went to the university and was a French major. And she, after a couple of years, she said she needed to learn more about French. So she went to the Sorbonne. And she studied in Paris for a year or two. And her first husband was Bulgarian. And so she went in Bulgaria. If you're an American, you work at the American Embassy. And so it was there that's the origin for this recipe for surmi, which is you really hate to say stuffed cabbage because it doesn't sound very
elegant.
No,
yes, no.
But this
but
is
now
made
you
with
might
pepper.
Give the name of it again. Surmi, S-E-R-M-I, is this dish of lamb and cabbage. So you stuff the cabbage leaves with lamb. Is that the
idea? Well, you mix up the lamb with California brown rice, and you season it with rosemary, black pepper, and mint. And you put that in the pot with onions and tomatoes, and it's just the most delicious stuff. And as a byproduct, it's full of vitamin C, so it's really good for you if you have a cold.
So your mother, and this was in the 1930s.
That's right.
She's over in Europe learning how to make surmi. And well, she brings that recipe home to. Now you said she grew up in Kansas.
She did.
She didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was raised on a ranch in Oklahoma, and we had one neighbor within a mile, but we had the only flush toilet.
My guest is Dave Morgan. He lives in Chico now, and he has put together a collection of recipes, Morgan Favorites, tested by five generations, and. On the back of your book, you say, the Sunday morning omelet that makes travelers change their plans. So, boy, you whip up an omelet that makes people say, gosh, I can't leave his house now. I've got to stay and have some omelet.
This omelet that I've invented is fairly popular with the family members. And so they, whenever any of the kids and grandchildren show up, they always try to have their visit overlap with Sunday morning because that's when I cook this omelet every week. And they seem to like it a lot.
Well, I happen to be very fond of omelets, both eating them and making them. But I had opinions when I was looking at your omelet recipe, Dave, I have to admit, because everybody has opinions on food. So one was, you use a non-stick frying pan. And my preference is to use all the olive oil and butter I can put in a pan, so it doesn't need to be nonstick. So do you apparently...
I put lots of olive oil and butter in also.
In addition to it being nonstick. And then you just whipping up some water in with your eggs, which I sometimes do too when I think of it, And do most people put a few drops of, like, teaspoons of water in when they're whipping up the eggs for the omelet?
Well, if you don't, the eggs are gooey. And so to get the right amount of fluff in it, I did some experiments. And you can't find this in anybody else's book, but the correct amount is 1 teaspoon of water per egg.
Mm-hmm. I was getting interested in that because I just dump a little bit of water in there. I don't measure it, but I'm going to follow your advice.
That's the right amount. And
a teaspoon per egg. So if you have 4 eggs in the omelet, that's 4 teaspoons of water.
Bingo.
When you're whipping up the eggs. Also, something that you say in your omelet, you use poblano peppers, and you also say what peppers not to use in an omelet.
Well, it's the grocery stores, especially in Northern California, make it tough on you because they call what we know as poblano peppers are mislabeled as pasillas. And so then you write down the recipe and you say, well, I can't put poblano because they don't know what that is. They call them pasillas. So then you say pasilla. You send it to your daughter in Brooklyn, and she buys pasillas and burns everybody out cooking omelets. So the problem really is the food distributors in Northern California, and we know who they are, and we're going to get them.
So for mislabeling peppers.
Yes. So anyway, for the poblanos.
So then you get in trouble. You get blamed for passing along this recipe when it wasn't your fault.
I've been blamed for lots of things, and it's never my fault.
Of course. My guest is Dave Morgan. He lives in Chico and has put together a collection of recipes, Morgan favorites, tested by 5 generations. And then you have testimonials on the cover of your book. What did Benedict Arnold say about your recipes?
Well, what else could he say? He says it's traitorously good food.
And then hunter Daniel Boone.
Well, Daniel Boone's been hunting for these recipes. And
of course, our president, who was famous for his bully pulpit, said...
Well, Teddy Roosevelt said, "Wooly bully," because that's what Teddy Roosevelt says.
That's what he would say. So people who are looking at your book know that you wrote this with your tongue firmly in your cheek.
That's right.
Well, I want to get back to some of your recipes in there. For example, you have a recipe for Welch rabbit, and we say rabbit because it's close to what it really is.
Well, it was inspired by Welsh rarebit, and it's what I was fed this recipe from probably age 4 on, and for a youngster, it's very simple: 1 egg, the same amount of milk as the egg, so you measure it in the eggshell.
Yeah, that's a curious thing too that I'd never encountered, using an eggshell as a measuring tool.
Well, how big is an egg?
Mm-hmm. So eggs come in different sizes. So if you want equal quantities of milk and egg, you just pour the milk in the eggshell, and there you've got it.
Bingo. And so the milk, the egg, and an ounce of American cheese. And it's important. I mean, I didn't really understand this to begin with, but it's true. You have to use American cheese because it tastes the best when you use the American cheese. You do not use processed cheese food. many of the packages say that. Only a few say American cheese. And so that's what you have to use, and it tastes just right when you do it that way.
Well, you know, when I was reading that, I remembered my mother, when I was a kid, would make Welch rabbit from time to time. She didn't make it often, so my memory of it is not very clear, but I don't remember her using American cheese. Maybe she did, I don't know. But it wouldn't have occurred to me if I were making something that called for cheese, not to just substitute some other cheese. But you said, no, those others don't work.
Well, you've tried them, and it's not as good. And there's another thing, a real Welch rabbit, that's like they make in Wales, she is usually just melted cheese on toast. But for the British, that's a sophisticated recipe. my Oklahoma variation is just different.
Well, I mentioned that you have this surmi that your mother brought back from Bulgaria when she was there in the 1930s. And there are other terms for foods that I never heard of. There's lumpia, which is a Filipino dish, apparently.
I had to make lumpia. Our friend Claire Pelly was going to the Philippines with the Peace Corps. And so for her send-off dinner, I figured out how to make lumpia, and we had lumpia for everyone just to get her into the mood of Filipino food.
And then you have a dish from Laos, larb.
That's one of the kids' favorites. And when I make it with beef, I cook the beef. They don't like to there, but I think you need to cook it just a little bit. I made it last week with chicken, but it's a mixture of the meat with spices, and you put that in a lettuce leaf and pop it in your mouth and wash it down with Mai Tais.
You have a recipe for gazpacho, and I happen to be very fond of gazpacho. In the summertime, when all those particular vegetables are in order, I'm often in Spain or France. And in fact, I remember one time the gazpacho was so good, I asked I think it was a pardo in Spain, asked for the recipe, and it was nothing like your recipe, Dave. You've got beef broth. Of course, you can call gazpacho. I mean, you can stretch the recipe, but I think people would be surprised that you put beef broth in your gazpacho, and you do not put green bell peppers.
I don't put green bell peppers in anything. poblanos are always better.
Because in Spain and in France, you put green peppers, red peppers, tomatoes. But you prefer poblanos in your gazpacho.
Well, in gazpacho, spaghetti sauce, meatloaf, I don't care.
Well, now, where did you come up with the idea to put beef broth in gazpacho?
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Oh. Well, if your family tested it and they like it, then that speaks for itself. You have an essay on popcorn, and I was curious to know what you'd have to say about popcorn. And what surprised me, a couple of things. One is you used a butter substitute. And I thought, boy, there is no substitute for real butter.
Well, if you use ghee, that used to be real butter.
Yes.
And so that's what I use.
Yeah, okay. But then also you say it's better to mix various kinds of corn. And I hadn't thought about that. It makes sense, I suppose. But what kinds of corn do you mix? You don't just take one kind of popcorn and pop it.
Well, there are, in my experience of popcorn, and if I've been eating, I've eaten lots of popcorn for a long time. And I found that you find different kinds of varieties of corn, just like with any other ag product, there are different varieties.
For example?
Well, you have your generic yellow popcorn. You have Orville Redenbacher's that pops into really big, big pops. And then there's red, white, and black, which are all kind of small kernels, but they have an intense flavor. And it's pretty much the same, the red, white, and black. So if you mix those three, the small white popcorn, the yellow generic, and Orville Redenbacher, and you mix them, you know, maybe one-third, 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 or however you want, any way you mix it, the mix is a lot better than any of them separately. So
that makes sense to me. I'm going to try that, Dave.
It works.
So that sounds like a lot of fun. Now, in addition to your recipes, I might remind people, my guest is Dave Morgan, and his collection of recipes he calls Morgan Favorites, tested by five generations. But in addition to recipes, well, I guess maybe you'd call it a recipe, but you have a way to get rid of the smell of skunk.
Oh, that's very important. And if your dog gets sprayed by a skunk, you can understand immediately how important that is. There's probably nothing more important that you can think of at the time. And what we've learned, again, I've learned so many things the hard way, and this is one more thing. You've heard about putting tomato juice on your dog when he gets skunked.
Yes.
Well, that gives you a pink dog that still stinks. So you need to follow the recipe in the book and it's literally a magic potion. You mix this, you pour this onto the afflicted animal, and it's like you're erasing it with an eraser. The skunk smell goes away. And it works on children too. I mean, you don't have to have a dog. And it's a magic formula, and you have to have it.
Do you want to give us a clue as to what's in it?
Well, the big operative ingredient is a quart of hydrogen peroxide, which they don't carry at 7-Eleven. And so if it's 11:30 at night and you
when
need
when your dog has encountered a skunk.
When your dog comes home skunked, you know, you can let the dog sleep under the bed, or you can go to your pantry and get out that quart of hydrogen peroxide you got the previous summer just in case, and mix up some of this stuff and hose down your dog and you're done.
Well, in addition to how to take care of the skunk smell, you have an ant, and I'm not sure when I read it whether it was an ant repellent or it actually kills the ants, but not instantly if you do it right.
Well, again,
because I recently just in the last few days, a few little ants decided they liked my kitchen. And so I was wishing, this was just before I came across your recipe for what to do with ants.
Well, this is a simple organic recipe that's harmless.
Yeah, because see, that was the thing. I didn't want to kill the ants, and I didn't want to put something in my kitchen that was toxic. I didn't want to poison myself. So this sounds great. How do you deal with ants?
Well, again, I'm giving away the store here, but people will buy the book on Amazon for other reasons.
Well, and they won't remember the proportions, so you can tell us what's in your ant repellent.
So it's very sophisticated. There are two ingredients, honey and borax.
And see, the honey surprised me because usually you don't want spilled honey on the counter because that's what attracts the ants.
Well,
but I guess that's what you want.
See, we're smarter than the ants because we have bigger brains. And so we lure them with the honey, and then they take home the borax, and they never come back. So it's really that simple.
So you don't have you don't have ant carcasses on your counter because they crawl away. And I think you do say in your book that if they don't have a chance to crawl away, it's because you had too much borax.
That's right. If they don't make it home. So, Nancy, you don't have to put this mixture on your counter. What we do is to take old toilet paper tubes, and we create those every week. And dab a little of this mixture in the toilet paper tube.
Inside
the tube, and then the ants will find it and go away. And after a week, they stop coming back. And then every 6 months or a year, you replace the tubes with new fresh ones with more honey and borax. And I have some friends who used to have lots of ants, and they've achieved success. Another thing about doing this toilet paper tube project with the honey and borax is it's a good project for campfire girls or it's a craft project for kids.
Kids can do this.
And they can paint it. They can put messages on the tubes. They can they can decoy the ants by calling it an ant hotel.
Well, before we finish, I do want to mention that you also, in addition to other recipes in your book, you live on an acre here in Chico where you have 6 olive trees that were planted by W.R. Hearst in 1873. I wish I had time to talk to you more about that, but we'll save that for your next book, and I'll ask you about your olive trees that were planted in 1878. It's been such fun talking to you about your book, Dave. My guest has been Dave Morgan. His book is Morgan Favorites, Tested by 5 Generations. After a short break, I'll be back with mystery writer Katrina McPherson, who will be the guest speaker at the Chico Library next Tuesday. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, host of Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Katrina McPherson was born in Scotland and lived there until 2010 when she moved to California. She has a PhD in linguistics from Edinburgh University and held an academic position for a while. She is now a full-time fiction writer, the multi-award-winning author of detective stories set in Scotland in the 1920s. The heroine of this mystery series is a wealthy and witty aristocrat and sometimes amateur sleuth named Dandy Gilver. Katrina McPherson will be the guest speaker at the Chico Library next Tuesday, May 17th at 7 p.m., and Chico Friends of the Library invites the public to this free event as their way of thanking our community of readers. Katrina McPherson, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you have described yourself as a born swat. That's not a word that most people are familiar with. So why do you describe yourself that way?
Oh, yeah, I know. We're still so deeply divided by that common language. I have a lot of fun with my American editors with these books that are set in Scotland. So a swat is much easier to explain these days post-Harry Potter because it's Hermione Granger, someone who sits at the front of the class, puts her hand up for every question, does all her homework early, and just it's less loaded than a teacher's pet. It's just someone that loves school and wants to do it all right all the time. So,
and that, I might say that's
not very cool.
I might say the word is spelled S-W-O-T if people want to look that up. So you, in fact, loved being a student so much that you were a student for until you were about 30 years old, right?
Yeah, I did. I went to school and then to university. Did a master's degree and then did a PhD quite slowly because I loved doing the PhD so much. And the only thing I did in between bouts of university was work in a library. So there was no kind of Jack Kerouac at all about my youth. But I did adore it. I didn't much like being a professor once the time finally came. I prefer being a fiction writer.
Well, you said you like being a student. You like studying linguistics, right?
Yeah.
And I understand that because that's my background. Graduate work.
Oh, really? Oh,
yes.
Yeah. What was your area?
French linguistics. That was my master's in French linguistics from Indiana University. And I just loved all kinds of languages, and I still do. Sanskrit, you name it, and I just find it fascinating. And words also. So that's why I pick up on a word like swat or these other Anglicisms that Americans don't often aren't often familiar with.
I know we always wonder if we should have a glossary in the the books, especially in the ones in the 1920s. Well, I'm up to 1932 now, because as well as the British English, there's the archaic language as well, but we have never had. And then sometimes, you know, there's a herring fishing village or a circus, so there's all kinds of dialect that goes with these settings as well. But usually I have a bit of a fight with the editor. You know, I put lots in and then she takes some out and we settle some.
My guest is Katrina McPherson, and she is a mystery writer. She writes full-time now, and she has a heroine named Dandy Gilver, who is a society sleuth. But before you became a full-time writer, you say you were an academic, and you didn't like being a professor, is that it?
No, I wasn't very good at it. I mean, I wasn't very good at it. No, I didn't. I love the subject matter. And I like the students. And I like teaching. Don't mind public speaking, thankfully, since I'm just about to come up to Chico and speak to the friends of the library there. But I wasn't at home with the shenanigans that go along with university.
Ah, the politics of it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I just didn't get it. Most of the time, I didn't know. And I didn't know what it was I didn't get. You know, you have to know a little bit even to navigate your own confusion. I was utterly bewildered by it. And it took me a long time to think, I don't like this. That's what's wrong. I don't like this place. I don't want to do this. So that was a massive light bulb then. I love everything about writing. Absolutely. Is that true? Yep. That's true.
You know that Chico is a university town. We've got Chico State University, we've got Butte College, and so there are a lot of academics in this community.
I know. I maybe just keep that one under my hat. Not that I don't like academics. I'm married to one. My husband's a professor. That's why I live in Davis in California. He's a professor at UC Davis now. Mm-hmm. Well, and that was really helpful, actually, to see someone who was a round peg in a round hole and got it and loved every part of academic life. That helped me see that it just was a bad fit for me. Well, so my friends-in-law are all professors still.
Well, my husband and I'm a widow now, but my husband and I lived in Davis, and he was a professor. He's an academic, and he felt more like you did. He didn't care for the politics of being a university professor. So he retired early, and he also became a writer, but not to the degree that you have. I mean, you are astounding. You are so prolific. My goodness, how many books have you written?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, the one that I'm working on right now is number 20. And I think that's because I started when I was 35, it was like I was being a cannonball, being shot out of a cannon. I'd held it all in for so long. That it just started to burst out of me. And I've been writing at least one book a year since then. It was 2001 that I started. And last year, actually, and this year, three, which is not a fast track to serenity by any means. But it's I still love it.
And when you came out with your character, this upper-class society sleuth, this was before Downton Abbey became such a phenomenon in the United States.
Yeah, it was, but I caught that wave, which was
you
just
certainly did.
Splendid timing for me. I had brought out the fifth book in this series just about when I was going to move to California, and my agent in London went to the big book fair in Frankfurt to sell foreign rights and added the line, "And she lives in California," to my biography, which piqued the interest of American publishers. And it was just when Downton Abbey fever was taking hold of America. And that book happened to be set in a big house where my detective goes undercover as a servant. So there was a lot of serendipity then. And it took off from there. So thank you, Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes. And I loved Downton Abbey. I loved Gosford Park and adored Downton Abbey. I feel quite bereft now. That it's over.
My guest is Katrina McPherson, and she is a mystery writer. She has written a series of books featuring Dandy Gilver, a society sleuth. And the author of the Downton Abbey series is actually from that class himself, so he knows that world. What did you do to get into this world of high society?
Exactly. I was going to say that, yeah. What did the likes of me do? Because I am tremendously not of that world. I am. If we were in Britain, you'd know that from the way I sound. Maybe you do know that from the way I sound because you're a linguist. But in America, I think it's enchanting that some people hear me and think I sound posh or fancy in any way, because this is a solid working class accent. I'm a blue collar girl, first person in my family ever to go to college. I am not Dandy Gilver. But now, what did I do? Well, I lived on an estate like the Downton Abbey estate, but much more modest than that incredible Highclere Castle. But I lived in the old shepherd's house in an estate with a laird and his lady, who were our neighbours. We called them by their first name. But it's not hard to tap into that because it's such a settled society in rural Scotland anyway that nothing much has changed. And I also, my parents still live, and I was born in the village where my father was born. It was a very settled place. And these tremendous women who were, it's a horrible way to talk about them, but the way they were talked about was they were the spare women after the lost generation of young men in the First World War. Mm-hmm. These amazing spinster ladies who never married because their sweethearts had died. They were still running things in my village when I was a child. They ran everything. They ran the libraries, they ran the church, they ran the brownies and the guides and the everything in village life. And I spent my childhood listening to their stories and admiring them. I can still remember the moment when I thought, all these ladies, Miss Brown and Miss Anderson, who run everything in my little village, I remember the moment when I connected them with the study of the history of World War One and the dreadful death toll, this kind of spark of thinking that these people that I know are those young women, now in their 70s. So it's not that hard, really, because Scottish, rural Scottish life is so similar. And also, there was my work. In between MA and PhD, I worked for 2 years in the local history library, in the central library, in the Carnegie Library in Edinburgh, in the Edinburgh room, archiving and cataloguing and finding out all about the social history of the city. So there was that as well. That was luck. But it certainly has paid out since.
I might remind listeners that you did mention, the 1920s, your first book begins in the spring of 1922, and this is after World War One, after the First World War, and we see some of that in Downton Abbey. So I think for us Americans, Downton Abbey gives us a mental picture of a lot of what you write about. We can visualize this. We can see this in our imagination when we're reading your book.
Yeah, thank you. Because I mean, I see it because I'd spent a lot of time visiting these houses and parks and townhouses and castles and stately homes. And I call it research. It's not hard work. Go tramping around some lovely castle and call it a good day's hard work done.
Yeah. Well, in addition to the mental pictures, I read very slowly because I hear characters speaking at the pace of normal speech rather than most people read a lot faster than I do. But I imagine the voices of these people. So if you would indulge me, Katrina, I'd like to read a couple of sentences from your first book, and you can tell me how far off I am in reproducing your way you hear Daisy. Daisy is the person mentioned in this paragraph. The way you hear Dandy's speech. Of course, I'm older than you.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Okay. So, this is from chapter one in your first book. Before, an invitation from Daisy and Silas would always have been accepted, and if you grumbled, which he did, about the company, I could retort, which I did, if he cared to take over the organization of our social life, I should be happy to go where he chose. Now, I didn't mention that Hugh is her husband's name. Now,
that was brilliant. Oh. You sound so much more like her than I do. That's wonderful. Thank you.
But don't you hear her voice when you're writing your books?
Oh, yes. I hear her voice. I can't reproduce it. I can't. I can do all the villagers and yokels, you know, with the Scottish voices. But I can't. It doesn't come out of me. But yes, I hear it. And you cracked it there. Thank you.
Well, it is fun. I mean, your books are so much fun that I couldn't resist that. We might mention, because we mentioned that Dandy Gilver is the heroine in your books, might mention he in that sentence that I read about Hugh, you might tell people who Hugh is.
Yeah, Hugh is Dandy's husband, who is Scottish. Dandy's English. He's Scottish. And he lives on the estate where he was born and his father was born and his father's father was born. And his life's work is to hand the estate on intact and in good heart to one of his sons. They have two sons, Donald and Teddy. So he's very interested in field drainage and the pheasant chick rearing and the farms. And he loves maps. And he's a bit of a... Well, I suppose the Scottish expression is he's never going to set the heather on fire. He's not very exciting. It's quite hard to write a boring character without the writing just being boring. So he's never around that much. And actually, to be honest, I get fonder and fonder of him as the books go on. So now I'm working on book 11, and he's rounded out and come into his own a bit.
Well, here's what on the dust jacket of your first novel, Dandy Gilver, her husband back from the front, her children away at school, and her uniform growing musty in the attic, is bored to tears in the spring of 1922, and a little light sleuthing seems like harmless fun. So you're just, there's where you say that her husband is back from the First World War, but she's getting bored. So out of boredom, she gets interested in, well, for example, the title of this book is After the Armistice Ball. So she's getting ready to go to a ball. But then how do you work in the mystery part?
Well, she's asked to look into a case of missing jewels by her friend Daisy. I've forgotten Daisy's name. Daisy Dalrymple, is it? No, Daisy Esselman. Sorry, this
yes.
was a long time ago.
Yes.
Daisy Esselman. And she's asked for not very flattering reasons, because Dandy is not socially adept, particularly. She will crash in and ask questions in all innocence that other people would hesitate to ask. So Daisy handpicks her, not for very flattering reasons, to be the one to look into this jewel theft. And it, I thought the first book, I wanted it to be a jewel theft in a spirit of humble tribute to Dorothy L. Sayers, who I hugely admired then and still do, because Lord Peter Wimsey's first case was the case of the Attenbury Emeralds. So I thought just to pay my respects to the real writers of the Golden Age that I was trying to come along behind, I'll make her first case a jewel theft as well.
Well, now, you brought up the name Dorothy Sayers, and she is not on your list of things that you particularly like. You have a long list. I read things that you like. Dorothy Sayers didn't happen to be on that list, but you know
yeah,
what?
You're right.
You know what else I thought was glaringly missing from your list of people and things you like? Can you guess what it is?
No, but I'm getting ready to feel chastened.
Oh, no. I didn't mean that. But you have been compared, your stories have been, your novels, your mysteries have been compared to Agatha Christie. And so I thought, what? Agatha Christie isn't on this list.
She's not on that list either. No, I'm writing this down. I'm going to ask them. They'll be on the list by the end of today. No, isn't that strange? Maybe it's because, you know, it's like drinking water or breathing air. I think Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie and Marjorie Allingham and Niall Marsh and Michael Innes are not on that list. But maybe I think
they're too obvious.
Taking us red. They should be, though. I should put them on there.
Well, because
I'll put them on there. Thanks, Nancy.
Well, because your books have been compared to Agatha Christie, so that's why I thought maybe she might be on your list of likes.
Oh, yes. She's on my list of loves, absolutely. And I think she gets... I think we forget how... I mean, maybe, I don't mean you forget, but readers in general forget how astonishing she was at the time and how structurally original she was at the time. Now that we know what she did and we know the plot, she doesn't quite get her just desserts, I don't think. She doesn't get the kind of reverence that someone like Raymond Chandler gets, for instance, and that does always kind of annoy me, because neither one of them does everything. His voice is wonderful. His plots are just passing on, dot, dot, dot. Her plots are tremendous. Her voice is less so. But to me, neither one of them is absolutely everything, but they're both something pretty great.
My guest is Katrina McPherson, and she has a series of mystery novels featuring a society sleuth named Dandy Gilver. She will be in Chico. She's invited by the Chico Friends of the Library to come and give a talk on Tuesday. And I mentioned that Agatha Christie, I'll speak for myself, love the BBC productions of these mystery stories. I would love to see some of yours. Have you thought about that? I'm sure you must have.
Yeah, they have been bought by STV, which is the Scottish version of ITV, the people who made Downton Abbey. So it's a long, winding road from them buying the option to it actually hitting Masterpiece Theatre on the evening. But the first step is underway. And, oh, it would be just wonderful. If it was well done, I mean, if it wasn't well done, it would be a nightmare, but... Yeah, I'm quietly I'm not even hopeful. It's just, it's nice. It's good to have a toe on the ladder.
Well, I think we come to expect quality from BBC Productions, so I think you can expect quality. They actually do come through.
Oh, yeah, and the Masterpiece, I mean, Masterpiece Theatre Co., I don't know any television. I don't really understand that they spend a lot of money, put it that way. Yeah. They're involved in a lot of these BBC and ITV productions. So, and it's tremendously expensive to make period drama. I mean, per minute of film, to get these cars or the horses and the trains and to remove all the modern life, it's quite staggering how much money it eats up. I had always thought about radio, because you can see anything's happening on radio and it's a budget option. So a medium was my thought, but we'll see.
My guest is Katrina McPherson, and she is author of many books in a series of mystery novels. After the Armistice Ball was the first one, and because it is your first one, I would like for you to read a little bit from this book, if you would, Katrina.
Yeah, I will. When you had emailed me before this interview and said maybe you'd make a reading selection, I thought, I wonder if the very start, kind of the first sentence I ever wrote as a writer in 2001, I wonder what that would be. I mean, I polished it since. So this is Dandy Gilbert, and this is more or less as she walked into my head. I didn't make her up. I felt as if I just started to eavesdrop, and there she was.
A lot of writers say that. A lot of writers say that. Yeah, so I'm intrigued that you do. You feel that way, too, that you didn't have to make up this character. She just introduced herself to you.
She just arrived. And it's quite scary, because when you write the first book that way, and then you come to write the second book, you think, well, I don't know where to find her, because I don't know, I don't understand where she was last time. So I start to write again, and it might not be the same person. So I handed the draft of my second book to my husband, Neil, and said, you know, I don't want a lot of praise. Just tell me if this seems like the same woman or if it's just a different book. And mm-hmm. He looked at me after a couple of chapters as if I was crazy. So of course it's the same woman.
So he found that there was consistent.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And now I don't worry. I think she's there like a friend. I don't really have to worry about why she is who she is. I know that she'll be there next time I drop in to see her. But here she was as she arrived, chapter one of book one.
Good.
And people have to imagine your lovely southern British English voice, not my English voice. I am not, and I say this with neither pride nor shame, a sensitive soul, not one of those women whose recreation lies amongst things she cannot explain, sudden powerful convictions of who knows what exactly. I should not go so far as to say I have no finer feelings, but whenever I compare mine with those of my acquaintance, they do seem somewhat coarser in the main. I have never smiled that curling smile and nodded when told of some engagement or some divorce. Rather, any news of that kind tends to take me by surprise and leave me, let us face it, rather coolish. How am I to explain, then, the conviction I held from the earliest stage of the Ethland affair that somewhere here was such hatred, malign and unstoppable, that it must lead as flood water up and melt water down to violent death? So I'll leave it there. And that was pretty much the first, I think it was pretty much the first words I ever wrote as I sat down, having resigned from my tenure track job as a university lecturer to write stories. Oop. I still remember the trepidation.
My guest is Katrina McPherson, and she was reading from her first in a series of mystery novels, After the Armistice Ball. And you have a new book, so let's skip chronologically to Quiet Neighbors. Can you read us a little bit from that in the little bit of time we have left, Katrina?
Yes, I will. Now, this isn't a Dandy Gilbert novel. This
Correct.
Is, yeah. I now write modern, standalone, psychological thrillers, suspense novels. And this is from the latest of these, Quiet Neighbors. This is it's another very unglamorous heroine. She is a librarian. She's a cataloguer. And she has just walked into a little dusty tumble-down book shop in southwest Scotland in 2015. Her name is Jude. So here she is. Jude opened the front of the case and drew the little book out with something between a gasp and a whoop, pressing it to her chest with her eyes closed, giving thanks for it before she started to inspect the jacket and binding and state of the pages. It might be no good after all. Ex-library, grubby and stamped, glue from old tape on its end papers. But the yellow of its jacket was so bright, even the spine unfaded. She opened her eyes and screamed, dropping the book. A man, noiselessly sprung from nowhere, dipped and caught it in one deft hand, like a crocodile snapping its jaw on a gobbet of tossed meat. "That's my favourite sound," he said. I mean, dear me, of course, I mean the gasp, not the shriek. The cry of a book lover sighting a treasure. And he bestowed on Jude a wide grin, revealing strong yellow teeth stained in grey stripes from coffee or tobacco. He was a tall man, egg-shaped from sloping shoulders, a comfortable paunch, with frizzy hair, a halo around the high dome of his forehead, and the double sickle of roughly shaven jowls. His eyes, bright above extravagant dark pouches, twinkled at her for another moment before he looked down to see what he had saved from falling. "Ah," he said, smoothing the little book in his large papery hands. "Miss Buchan, I join you in your gentle delight." And he gave a bow. Douglas, said Jude, looking down to check she'd not made a mistake. Right enough, there was old Douglas's name in the familiar font over the sentimental drawing. "Oh, quite, said the large man. He had exactly the sort of accent people said, "Oh, quite, in. But, dear me, she's John Buchan's sister, you know, of the 39 Steps renown. She eschewed the allure of his reflected glory. Like dear old Nicolas Cage and the Coppola connection." Jude had been so primed for the name of dear old Scotley, someone she'd never heard of, that it took her a beat or two to understand him, and then she laughed, as delighted with this oddity as she was with her find. I'll leave her there.
Thank you. This has been my guest, Katrina McPherson, and she has been reading from her latest novel, Quiet Neighbors. Thank you so much, Katrina. We will look forward to seeing you here in Chico next Tuesday.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it very much, too.
I would also like to thank my first guest, cookbook author Dave Morgan, whose book Morgan's Favorites features recipes tested by five generations of his family. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.